Hey everyone, this is Jennifer.
And this is Paige. And this is Big Book Energy.
Thanks for coming back for our February bonus episode. Today we have our guest Kayla with us.
Hey, all you cool cats and kittens.
Oh, Jesus Christ, really?
Listen, I've been waiting for this opportunity and I was ready.
I was going to say, have you been planning this since we invited you on the show?
Yes, I have.
Yes. Well, thank you for coming on the show today. And this month, Kayla has picked a true crime book for us to go over. And that is Submerged by Janice Heil.
I'm not really sure
how to pronounce her last name. It's H-I-S-L-E. So I'm thinking Heil. We'll go with it.
Close enough for me.
And this is the story of Sarah and Ryan Widmer from, I think it was the Cincinnati, Ohio area, which this was kind of mid-2000s, getting into 2010s with the subsequent trials. So many of our listeners might actually have followed this story. It did make it onto national news. So this book was later written by Janice Heil, who had been a reporter at the time of the first trial, at least. Did she cover all three of them?
She was in all three of them, yeah.
So she covered all three trials with Ryan Widmer and later wrote a book about the experience because this case in particular just really stuck with her and she wasn't able to let go. And those unanswered questions really kind of haunted her and others connected to this case. So that is what we were talking about today. I am very excited because I love true crime. Morgan and I have been going through like an absolute true crime binge on Netflix lately. So I don't know why I haven't incorporated that into my reading life yet, but very much enjoyed this book. Anyone else have any first comments before we get into the summary?
I am a true crime web sleuth. So this is all my free time. It's just true crime. And so I'm very opinionated about this.
Okay, let's be for real. You're opinionated about everything.
I really am, but especially true crime.
Do you have any like favorite true crime podcasts that you listen to?
Yes. So they don't only do true crime. She also does like conspiracy theories and like myths and legends and stuff like that. But it's Mile Higher podcast, and it's a married couple and then their cousin, but they all do it together.
Mile Higher.
Yeah. So her name's Kendall Ray and then her husband, Josh.
So I know we actually on social media, like Instagram and Twitter, we follow a lot of podcasts and I would say probably like 50% of them are true crime podcasts. Like it's just a huge corner of the podcast market right now because it's so popular. I know that was actually what got me into podcasts originally was And That's Why We Drink, which has true crime and supernatural stuff. And then Wine and Crime was the other one. Yeah.
Yours always have alcohol with it too.
Yes. which also pans out for bookish podcasts. There's a lot of like alcohol themed book podcasts out there too.
We'll overlap there.
Yeah. All right. Anything else before we get into summary? Paige, you ready to take us away?
Let's do this. So, as we said, today's book is Submerged, which focuses on the trial of Ryan Widmer. And I will say that is W-I-D-M-E-R. I listened to the audiobook, so I thought that was Whitmer for a while.
Yeah. Honestly, it might be pronounced that way.
It sounds like it is. But if you Google Widmer case, you're going to get a very different case. So, heads up. Okay, so it's about Ryan Widmer and the death of his wife, Sarah, who died in their bathtub on August 11th, 2008. The basics of this are that some people believe Ryan murdered his wife by drowning her in their bathtub.
He did.
While others are convinced that Sarah suffered a medical emergency that caused her to drown in the bathtub.
No.
And I'm sure you can't guess which side of the fence Kayla has landed on.
She guilty.
Yeah, you're right. We are going to fight later. Okay. So let's break down the events of the night. Ryan called 911 saying that his wife had fallen asleep in the bathtub and that he thought she was dead.
Sketchy. That's so sketchy. Can I interject here? Or do we do that after? Okay, listen. I watch a lot of Criminal Minds, okay? And on Criminal Minds, they tell you that if your first thing, also other true crime things, but I'm saying Criminal Minds is a very baseline way to start this. If your first words are, my wife is dead, I think she fell asleep in the bathtub, you're switching blame. So, like, if she died on her own, wouldn't you run in and be like, oh my God, my wife is unconscious, or like, she's not breathing? Why is your first thing to say she's dead? Just saying, sketchy. Keep going.
Okay. We'll get into my thoughts on that later. He was instructed to pull her out of the tub, put her on a flat surface, unlock the door for emergency services, and then perform CPR.
Also weird.
Paramedics arrived on the scene and continued to try reviving Sarah before relocating her to the hospital. Ryan accompanied her and on the way called both Sarah's mom and his mom to meet them at the hospital. There, Sarah was pronounced dead. Ryan and his mom were informed much later about Sarah's death, but were not allowed to see her. Ryan was questioned briefly by the coroner, but not by the police officers. The next couple of days were filled with trying to plan Sarah's funeral for the family. But law enforcement suspected that Sarah hadn't fallen asleep in the tub like Ryan had said. Lead investigator Jeff Braley had this gut feeling that something terrible had happened, and this dude was not going to stop until he found out what that was. Couple of things that were noted here. Sarah's body was dry when paramedics arrived to revive her.
So weird.
Right, right. Not exactly what you would expect from a woman who had just been pulled out of a bathtub, granted. Second, Ryan had said that he'd been downstairs watching TV when Sarah drowned, only finding her after he'd come upstairs to go to bed. Except the downstairs TV wasn't tuned into the channel that Ryan said he'd been watching, the upstairs TV was. Also, there were two spots of blood on the carpet, which were immediately cut up and bagged that night. Fair assessment so far?
Fair assessment.
Okay.
Wait. But also, weird that my guy was only in some boxers and his clothes were dry. You just pulled your wife out of a bathtub, homie. Why aren't you wet? Carry on.
Braley was then present at Sarah's autopsy the next day, where the coroner wrote in manner of death as homicide. And with that, Braley was off to the races. He started interrogating Ryan's co-workers, and I do mean interrogate. Right, by the sounds of it, he kind of came at some of those women looking for signs of an affair. He got nothing on that front. Everyone said Ryan and Sarah got along perfectly and that they had a happy marriage. Will note they had been married for like 4 months at this point, so. Braley also scheduled a meeting to talk with Ryan, which Ryan agreed to. But at the urging of his friends and family, Ryan hired a lawyer, which I do have to say was a smart move at this point. There was some discrepancy as to what happens right now. Braley claims that the lawyer said that Ryan would not be available to talk. The lawyer says that Ryan would not be able to talk at that time, but would be available later on. Whatever was actually said, Braley responded by executing a search warrant 2 days after Sarah's death. While at the house, he dusted for prints on the bathtub and found some fingernail marks on the side, which he then responded by taking the entire bathtub with him as evidence. Like, the whole fucking tub.
Which was obtained illegally. I'll give that to Ryan's side.
Which was obtained illegally.
Yeah, it wasn't. It was not mentioned in the search warrant. Yeah.
It was not in the search warrant.
That's so crazy that you have to say, like, I'm taking your bathtub.
Specifically, yeah.
That's so crazy.
You have to list it out. Itemized list of what you want.
Itemized list. All right, this led to Ryan's arrest, which came as a huge surprise to everyone involved. Friends and family of the couple said they had a great marriage and that Ryan was a laid-back and chill kind of guy. Not anyone you would expect to murder his wife. Even Sarah's family was on Ryan's side, trying desperately to get him released so that he could attend Sarah's memorial service. This was when an important event happened. Ryan, at his bail hearing, was only there via video, and the image that popped up on the screen shocked a lot of people. Ryan looked pretty rough, which is probably to be expected for a guy with zero history of any sort of criminal offenses who had just spent the night in jail for the murder of his wife. For some reason, not disclosed by the police, Ryan was put in a suicide vest, which was a sleeveless black smock which showed off some tattoos that looked rather intimidating. basically he came across looking like a dude who 100% killed his wife.
Because he did.
Apparently, and I can't confirm this because I listened to the audiobook, so no pictures for me, Ryan looked the complete opposite in his mugshot from the night before where he looked relatively harmless. Want to take a stab at which photo ended up in the media?
The murderer one.
The one with the tattoos.
It's 100% the one that makes him look guilty.
Yeah.
Let's be for real here. Ryan was released from jail on bond, but not enough time to attend Sarah's service. He did elect to have Sarah's body cremated because it was cheaper and practical, supposedly.
Sketchy.
But not before a second autopsy was conducted on advice from his lawyer. Honestly, again, a very smart move here. Because this autopsy was performed by a dude who had been involved in some high-profile cases. And I'm talking like JFK, MLK Jr., OJ Simpson, JonBenet Ramsey, big. Like, big, big cases.
How old is he?
He's gotta be ancient.
Seriously?
He's in his 90s. He's in his 90s.
Like JFK?
He's in his 90s now? Or he's in his
90s? Now he's in his 90s.
Oh, I was like, what?
Now.
So okay. He was he's like in his 90s now. 80s?
80s?
70s, yeah. Maybe?
70s, 80s. I think he's like 93 or something like
retire,
that.
Retire, so yeah, my guy.
When you're the goat, man, keep going.
Those consulting fees, I mean.
Yeah, for real. Seriously, though, we are in the wrong line of work, yeah. Y'all. Those are some... Those are some hefty consulting fees, and I would like a piece of that action. So his conclusion. Cause of death was drowning. No surprise there. But manner cannot be determined in this set of circumstances, but forcible drowning was not likely. And thus began a series of back and forths between the lawyers about what was admissible and what wasn't. During this time, Sarah's family cut off contact with Ryan, completely switching sides to the Ryan is a murderer camp. They haven't said why exactly that was, and apparently Ryan was blindsided by this. Which brings us to the first trial. The prosecution basically laid out the case that Ryan's story didn't add up because Sarah's body was too dry to have been pulled out of the tub when he called 911. Instead, she must have either been pulled out of the tub and left out for a bit, or only her head was submerged and even then was sort of left out for a little bit to dry off. Also, he did make some conflicting statements about whether he found her face up or face down in the bathtub.
Why would she be face down?
Like, if you're pushing her down?
Oh, yeah, I understand that. But like, if she drowned accidentally, like he's claiming, there's not enough room for her to flip herself while dead. Like, if you're in a bathtub, you gotta work a little bit to rotate yourself. Yeah, I just don't trust this man.
I could see maybe if she had, like, because they floated some possibilities of her potentially having some sort of seizure.
Right.
I could see maybe that would do it, but then you would probably expect to find water splashed around the bathroom, which also wasn't found.
And none of the bottles, like none of the shampoo bottles were knocked off. If you had a seizure and your head's right next to the bottles or like the Lysol wipes, that would have knocked over.
Mm.
Yeah,
it's true.
But unless he took the time to wipe everything down and clean up some of the water and put the little bottles back up in place after he drowned his wife, then, you know, then the scene would look how it did. But same.
Sarah also had some bruising to the back of her head and throat, which they interpreted as marks left by Ryan as he held her underwater, and the fingernail marks left on the tub were signs of Sarah resisting. Finally, the two blood spots on the floor were left by bloody foam coming from Sarah's mouth. Two, because Ryan repositioned her while staging the body. But one weird moment for the prosecutor was when one of their witnesses suggested that perhaps she wasn't drowned in the tub. She could have been drowned in the sink. Or the toilet. Which was mentioned literally nowhere else. But the prosecution immediately amended their documents with the court to allow for drowning anywhere, not just the tub. And that is also sketchy. My turn to be sketchy.
All right, I'll give you that. I don't think that a sink is deep enough to drown her in.
No, you only need like 3 inches of water to drown someone.
Yeah.
Really?
It definitely could be.
Yeah.
But I feel like if the sink is shallow enough where she could push herself up a little bit, get a few breaths in, put up a little bit more of a fight.
Maybe, but if like the back of her head hits the faucet and he's holding her down.
Yeah, but then she would have more marks on like the top of her head from smacking the faucet.
Like,
that's not a bad point.
She, like, I don't know. The one thing was, like, throughout the entirety of the book, they're talking about how, like, she doesn't have defensive wounds and he didn't have a mark on him either. And it's right. like, if someone is holding my head in a sink, a toilet, or a bathtub, like, I'm going to be flailing I'm around fighting. Like crazy. And yeah. it sounds like, according to her personality, she also would have done that as well. And so I'm like, ah, that, did she get drugs? Yeah. You know, it's just.
Yeah.
By all accounts, she was a firecracker yeah. and he was a laid-back dude. So this does not, the personalities don't exactly match up for an easy cut-and-dry case here.
No, and their argument is that the smeared handprints on the sides of the bathtub are her trying to push herself up.
Yeah.
So maybe if yeah. he bends her over the tub and just her head is in and it's like the face down, then that would be her pushing herself back up there. She wouldn't really be able to reach around to hit him if she was face down. So those marks could make a little bit of sense.
I will admit, I had a really hard time visualizing those scenarios.
I know.
Based off of the descriptions they gave in the book. So,
especially since that bathroom's supposed to be teeny tiny.
Yeah, super small.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Not enough room really to maneuver anywhere. So you would think a lot of stuff would be broken if that had happened. Especially since the door covers like half of the bathtub, apparently, whenever it's
open.
Open.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Anyway.
All right. So
we're getting to the discussion before right, we finish.
We're getting ahead of ourselves here. Okay. So Sarah was moved. Dude, you're always ready to fight. We'll get there. Hang on.
We just have to wait like 20 more minutes.
Almost there. Almost there. Okay. So the defense's argument was that there was no evidence of a violent struggle, no marks on Ryan at all, and that the wounds on Sarah were actually a result of the medical procedures conducted while trying to save her life. Sarah was moved, but with the help of a police officer who had instructed Ryan to do so, and that Sarah's body had dried during the time Ryan called 911 and the time paramedics arrived. There was zero motive for Ryan, and that Sarah had a history of migraines and falling asleep in random places, which pointed to an undiagnosed medical condition which led to her death. The results where Ryan was acquitted of aggravated assault but convicted of murder. Except one juror contacted defense a week later saying that juror misconduct had occurred. People were running their own experiments to see how long it took to dry off. And this resulted in a mistrial and everyone gearing up for round two.
Why aren't you allowed to do that?
You have to use life experiences. You can't do unsigned, like, they're not experts on this sort of thing.
So I can't go home while on this trial, lay myself in a bathtub, then lay on the bathroom floor with a timer?
You cannot.
Nope. Nope.
That seems messed up.
The real, like, linchpin of this whole issue is that the defense should be able to give you enough evidence in that courtroom that you do not have to do anything outside of what you witness in the courtroom to make your decision.
Okay, that
so,
makes sense.
Which kind of gets at my whole issue with several of these trials is that I don't think the defense convincingly proved to me as a fake juror that 100% that's what happened. But anyway, we can get to that later because I'm once again getting ahead of myself.
It's so hard to like keep your thoughts. I was reading this and I'm like, I'm pretty sure this gives away which side of the fence I fall on.
I know. I texted you this morning. I was like, so do you think he did it?
I know he did. And I was like, no, we're not talking about this right now.
Fight
later.
I was ready to fight.
Literally every time you call me, though. Like, that's just Tuesday with you.
I know.
Okay. Gearing up for round two. Ryan ended up getting a new, much more aggressive team of lawyers. His previous lawyer had been reluctant to do things like go after Braley after he heard some rumors about his behavior, as in misconduct. Team 2 had no such trouble. But the judge did not allow these rumors to be investigated or be able to put into evidence, but prosecution started to sort of distance themselves a bit more from him, so he didn't feature as prominently in the later trials. Trial 2 arguments were more or less the same way, just tighter arguments and more firm stances from all of the witnesses. They cleaned themselves up, basically. Sarah's mom, in particular, came out a lot firmer in making Ryan look like a controlling husband by calling Sarah after she spent $100 at Target and asking if she really needed to do so, which he explained as it being a joke later on. She also dismissed the idea of Sarah having any medical problems that would have resulted in her falling asleep in the tub. So this go-around, they got a hung jury. So now we go to trial three, because this case is fucking extra. And this is where some interesting developments come into play. An unknown woman came forward saying that Ryan had confessed to killing his wife to her several months earlier, but she hadn't come forward because she was afraid of Ryan. At trial, she did, like, give her name, so she was no longer an unknown woman. I just forget her name right now.
Jennifer.
What?
No, her name's Jennifer.
Oh.
What'd you do, man?
No, her name is Jennifer.
You getting involved in all this shit? That's not smart.
That's funny.
Okay, so Jennifer, not our Jennifer, this woman Jennifer, claimed that Ryan had called her drunk at 2 or 3 a.m., waking her up and telling her that he had killed Sarah and would kill her if she said anything. Defense poked all sorts of holes in this woman's story. The time didn't match up, the length of the call didn't match up, someone who had talked to Ryan just before said he wasn't drunk, and the woman continued to text him over 600 times after the supposed incident. So that ended up being a wash. Even the jurors said that they didn't really believe most of what she said. But Ryan also had a secret that was kept quiet during this time. He and another woman named Sarah, Sarah number two, had a baby boy. The relationship happened well after Sarah number one was dead, but that was still kept quiet during the trial for obvious media-related reasons.
Because he's sketchy.
Because the media's an asshole. Anyway, at trial, Sarah's mom doubled down again on the Ryan is an asshole thing, saying that Ryan and Sarah were hateful to each other, which is pretty inconsistent with what she said both pre-trial and more extreme than what she said at both previous trials. Also, one of the defense experts that had been at all three trials brought a little something extra to the table for this one. Pig brains, which is gross. This was used largely to illustrate that he thought the coroner had not performed the autopsy thoroughly enough by not preserving the brain, not gathering brain samples from the appropriate places, not gathering enough brain samples, and not gathering enough heart samples. Basically, defense was doubling down on the undiagnosed medical disease, particularly something called long QT syndrome, which matched a lot of Sarah's medical symptoms. But this time, Ryan was convicted of murder. Again. So once again, questions of improper actions by jurors were alleged, but nothing was actually proven. Attempts to overturn the ruling haven't been successful, and Ryan is currently serving a 15-to-life sentence. Now, our author, Janice, what did we decide?
Heisel?
I feel like the S is silent, but I don't actually.
We'll just call her Janice.
Sure. Janice.
Janice H. was a reporter who worked on the Widmer case since it broke. She covered all of the trial hearings and had gone back and forth on whether or not Ryan was guilty of killing his wife. So with this case continuing to rattle around in her mind, she reached out to Ryan. Ryan hadn't taken the stand in any of his three trials.
Smart.
That is smart for him.
Really smart.
Not a good talker. Not a good talker. He had spoken both times after being convicted, saying that he wasn't guilty, that he loved his wife, and then again in a television interview. And in that television interview, he apparently did not come out looking good. He alleged that there was a conspiracy to convict him among paramedics, cops, and several other people that I'm blanking on right now.
The prosecutors, Yeah.
He thought the coroner was in on it. Like, he thought
everyone
was after him.
He drank the Kool-Aid on that one. He's like, everyone drank the Kool-Aid. Everyone was coming out.
Nice. Sounds a little guilty to be pointing fingers like that, if you ask me.
It does not sound good. I'll give you that.
Thank you so much.
But people around him have always maintained that he was never good at communicating clearly. He often answered in short answers, almost blunt, and mixed up his words a lot. Something that the author confirmed after she interviewed him in person. Supposedly, it took some poking and prodding to get answers out of him.
I mean, I would expect that.
Yes,
when interviewing a convicted murderer. But anyway.
Here's my life story.
All right, but she did get a timeline events from Ryan that might change what people think about what happened that night. Ryan said that once he saw Sarah in the tub, he immediately drained it and pulled Sarah's head and shoulders out of the tub. He then ran into the bedroom to grab his phone and called 911, but his phone dropped the call. So instead, he grabbed Sarah's phone, and he got 911 on that call, and that's when he pulled Sarah completely out of the tub, having to pivot around the door to do so.
Is there a record of this first call?
I don't think that it said.
Okay.
Yeah.
So theoretically, this allowed for more time for Sarah's body to dry out before the paramedics arrived, and allows for less water all over the place if Sarah was pulled out of a dry bathtub. This was the main sticking point, as we have said, for jurors in every case, how dry Sarah was. Now, clearly, this isn't for sure that this would have changed anything in the jurors' minds, but if that was the main issue, you know, it may have. Also, during her continued digging, she uncovered some stuff about Braley. This is the misconduct issues we were talking about earlier. Dude apparently lied on his resume to give himself more credentials. And unleashed a raid on some guy's 50-something-ish birthday party because of an uncorroborated tip about underage drinking. Which sounds extremely excessive to me. Like, take it down a couple notches there, bro.
Dude's 20 or 50. He's clearly old enough to drink.
Yeah. Right? No shit. I don't know. Also, the coroner reached his decision pretty quickly in this case, too. The Widmer family ended up having another experience with the exact same coroner when Ryan's mom passed away after complications from excessive alcohol consumption following Ryan's trials. The same coroner that had done Sarah's autopsy performed Ryan's mom's, and that took over a month to complete. A little bit, just a little, slower than the 1 to 2 day turnaround it took on Sarah's.
Yeah, that doesn't sketchy. Look good. That one doesn't look
yeah.
good. Maybe he was just like, yo, this family's giving me a lot of shit for my first autopsy I did for them. Let me really make sure it was alcohol the second time, you know?
That is a level of petty that deserves a straight just that's, junk punch I mean, for that one.
Yeah, that's like, unprofessional. But
oh, it's so unprofessional.
I can see, because over and over again through the book, we are told, like, having a murder happen in this county was, like, super rare. So I could see, like, maybe he was getting pressure from the police department to get a quick turnaround, but 1 to 2 days is still really short. And he's not supposed to approach this as a homicide. He's supposed to approach this with as much of an unbiased opinion on the cause of death as he can. Unless, right. It is quite short.
And Braley was there the entire time, too. Yeah. So that does not...
Well, Braley and Hutzler?
Mm-hmm.
Hetzler? So both of them were
yeah.
there.
So that's the DA, right?
The DA, yeah.
Ryan is still in prison for the death of his wife. If you are at all interested in doing a deep dive in this case for yourself, I can tell you from experience that if you Google the Widmer case, you'll find all of the press releases from the days at trial. Like, I Googled that earlier to get names. Shit ton of stuff came up.
Also, YouTube the newlywed drowning, and you'll get a lot of people voicing their opinions.
Yeah, that was like the nickname they gave the case, right?
Yeah, and then you can easily find his full 911 call.
Yeah,
yeah, that's all over the place. That actually showed up in the audiobook as well, yes. Clips of it. So it's pretty easy to get info on this. Admittedly, while this author claims that she hasn't fully decided whether or not Ryan is guilty, this book feels a lot like it leans into the not guilty camp, mm-hmm. in my opinion.
Agreed.
Yeah.
Yeah. So if you're looking for both sides of the coin, go look at the documentaries. It sounds like they're all Ryan's a killer. And then read this book. It sounds like Ryan's not a killer. And we'll leave it there. We'll go to Folio Facts and we'll come back and we'll fight.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm excited for the fighting. Today in Folio Facts, like I mentioned earlier, I don't think actually once we were recording, I think this was before we start recording, I tried to match the murder theme of the book, and so I decided to talk today about Anne Perry. Anne Perry is a famous crime/thriller author. She's written like over 100 books. So she's really prolific. I think her first book was published in 1979, so she has been at this for a while, but she is very prolific as an author. Her two most famous series of mysteries are the Thomas Pitt and William Monk mysteries. They're both kind of Victorian era detective stories. She is hugely successful. I mean, obviously she's published over 100 novels. And I kind of group her together with like the Nora Roberts, John Grisham, Nicholas Sparks type camp. You know, these are books that you see like everywhere you go. And then like in weird places, like sometimes grocery stores have books and like that's where you would see like Anne Perry, you know? However, I had never actually read any of her work. I've just kind of seen her in passing and associated her with those other authors. Turns out she's an actual murderer.
Oh, shit.
I love that.
What?
She is an actual murderer.
Plot twist.
When she was 15 years old in 1954, she conspired with her best friend, Pauline Parker, to murder Parker's mother, Honora. I should also mention Anne Perry is not her birth name, that she changed her name. Understandable, probably.
Yeah, probably but smart.
She was born Juliet Marion Hulme. Hulme, H-U-L-M-E. I don't know how to pronounce that one either, so that's fun. And apparently her parents were in the process of getting a divorce, and she lived in New Zealand at the time, and they kind of told her, you're going to go stay with some relatives in South Africa. I don't know why she wasn't going to stay with her mom or her dad, but she wasn't very happy with this plan, and she hoped that her best friend, Pauline, who apparently the pair had like a weird, very obsessed relationship. They were very close. There's been some speculation that it might have been sexual, but both Anne and Pauline, I think, have kind of denied it. It's just more of like a weird like obsession. But she was hoping that Pauline would be able to come with her. However, Honora, Pauline's mother, refused to let Pauline go to South Africa, which I'm like, that makes sense to me.
Right? Shocker.
And it was at that point that the pair decided that they were going to just murder her mother and still somehow go to South Africa. I'm not sure how they planned to get away with this, but it was definitely premeditated. They arranged for Honora to go on a walk with them through kind of like a secluded area of a park. Holm Perry dropped like something on the ground as a pretense to get Honora to kind of bend over. And it's at that point that they attacked her with rocks, beating her over the head. They thought that one blow to the head would be enough to kill someone. So, I mean, they were teenagers, right?
Right.
However, when one blow did not kill Pauline's mother, they proceeded to hit her over the head 20 times with rocks until she was dead.
Holy shit.
Ow.
Ugh. They were both arrested, shockingly.
What?
However, in New Zealand at the time, they were too young to be considered for the death penalty. They were both 15, I think. So they both ended up serving, do you want to guess how much time in prison?
6 months.
5 years.
5 years. Ding, ding, ding. They both served 5 years. And afterwards were released. Holm, at that point, changed her name to Anne Perry. She moved to Scotland. She lived with her mother later on at the time. And in 1979, she published her first crime novel.
Okay, if you knew that your kid murdered their best friend's mom, could you as a mother live with that kid? I'd be so scared.
I don't know.
I made the wrong dinner. Is she going to hit me over the head with a rock tonight? I asked her to make her bed.
Is she
going to
stab me with a knife later?
Yeah. Is tonight the night?
It was just, it's very odd because in the brief like articles and stuff I was reading about this, especially how Anne Perry talked about it later in life. She very specifically talks about how I did my time, I paid my price, and now I've moved on with my life. So there seems to be kind of like a general lack of remorse. She does acknowledge that she did a bad thing. She's like, when you do something that's wrong, you need to pay a price for that. However, I don't know that, like, 5 years in prison really is justified for beating a friend's mother over the head until she dies. Like, that seems very violent. So I think probably their strangely close relationship had a lot to do with it. We've seen that with cases like the Slender Man case, where there's just, like, a weird dynamic between groups of teenage girls or just teenagers in general that happens. But yeah, she's overall seems very, like, literally over it. She's over it. She's like, I went to prison and now I'm out of prison. And apparently no one knew that Ann Perry was actually a murderer until a documentary, or it was either a documentary or like a film adaptation of her story aired like in the mid-2000s, like early 2010s. Okay, let me back that up. It was 1994 in a film called Heavenly Creatures, which starred Melanie Lynskey and then also Kate Winslet, who played Ann Perry's character. So up until 1994, she's been publishing for like, you know, getting close to 20 years. No one knew that she was Juliet Holm.
She's just writing different adaptations of killing best friends' moms?
I don't think so, but I haven't read her books, so I don't know.
Right? Like, in my mind, it's just, like, she's a serial killer instead of actually killing people. She's, like, writing about killing people.
She's just living out her dreams of murdering
people. She's like, I'm not saying that I murdered someone, but if I did, this is how I'd do it.
This is how I do it. That is so scary. Sounds like she's much more criminally sophisticated at this point than she was, because that was not a crime of a mastermind when she was 15.
No, it really wasn't. But yeah, she is a very successful author. Many of her novels have been made into movies. She actually moved to Los Angeles a few years ago to, like, better oversee her film adaptations. Very successful.
No, I could never. I'd be so scared. I'd be like, oh my God, I said my line wrong. Is she gonna kill me?
I mean,
I took the last blueberry muffin. Is she gonna kill me? No, I could never.
So that is Ann Perry. And I actually found a really interesting Vice article that lists, it's a list of 5 crime authors that are actually murderers, either before or after they started writing. So I will link that in the show notes as well, so you guys can take a look at other authors who also just casually kill people.
That doesn't really surprise me.
No. It doesn't, but it's like, really?
Yeah, it's a little spooky.
Yeah. Especially also, considering, go ahead.
If Ann Perry is listening to this, because maybe she listens to book podcast, I was just kidding. Please don't kill me. Okay, carry on.
We think you're fully rehabilitated. Everything's fine.
Yeah, you did your time. You paid the price for your crime. We're all good. No judgment
over
here.
Fight me, you did not. 5 years is not enough.
Shh, don't say that, Paige.
Just fight me, man. Liz, no.
She's a murderer. Shut up.
Yeah. So, yeah, well, I'm not going to. That's Ann Perry.
I'm not going to pick up her dropped handkerchief, like, if I'm walking alone in the woods with her. This is not Victorian England, and, like, no.
Definitely not.
I would pick it up and I would do the Elwood's bend and snap, and then she would snap my neck. So.
Well, on that cheery note.
Yeah.
Let's fight.
Let's fight.
All right, are we ready to get into this?
Wait, let me get a drink of coffee. This.
All right, you want to go first?
Who, me?
Yeah, you.
You're the guest of honor, so you get to go first.
He guilty.
I guess, should we say what the question is?
Oh, yeah, okay.
Yeah, our very first discussion question, just in case you couldn't tell from us talking about it, do you think he is guilty of murdering his wife?
Yes.
Kayla says yes, and go. Why?
Okay, many reasons. Well, okay, yes, he did it, but there's also, with my research, I found that she had the DNA of another female underneath her fingernails. Which I find interesting, because if you were in the bathtub between 15 and 30 minutes, all your undernail gunk would have come out. So that female DNA would have come out, which I find interesting. I've only seen it in like a few places that it was there, and they haven't run the DNA. They matched it to like, or they ran it against the mom and some females that were close to the family, but no one really else, which I find interesting because he was very quick to jump on the bandwagon of these other women. He met Sarah too because she was on a website saying that he did not murder his wife, and she wrote him in as a fan saying that she supports him. Then he responded, and they kept going back and forth, which I find suspicious that you chose to continue the conversation with her and not any of the other females that continued to message you. So I also think that that gives a little value to Jennifer's story that he was confiding in her. Maybe he didn't straight up say, I murdered my wife, but in some details of what was going on, because he willingly gave out his phone number and personal email to Jennifer. So that's a little weird to say, oh, she knows nothing whenever you're talking to her as much as you are. She did take it a little bit too far by, you know, sending 600 text messages, but you never know. Also,
just a bit.
So I'm not married, but like if I walked in on, I don't know, one of my sisters or my mom unconscious in a bathtub, I don't think I would take the time to drain the bathtub. That just seems very weird to me, or worry about finding the phone first. I think my first instinct would be to pull them out of the bathtub, like just rip them out, get them on the flat surface, because leaving them in there just seems weird. Like what if she was unconscious but not dead yet, and you're just leaving her in the water? Then I would call 911. Plus, I think it's interesting he called 911 and there's like no record of him calling it on his phone, or there's said to be no record, because if you call 911 and then hang up or the call drops, they call you back. They get the little record thingy from experience of prank calling 911 as a child and then calling back. They call back. So I don't buy that. It's weird that there was water nowhere. Like, it's not really wet up in there. Her body's dry. Her hair was damp, not wet. So even if you drained the bathtub and pulled her out, her hair would still be dripping everywhere. If you pulled her out, why weren't the bottles knocked over? And why were you so quick to impregnate another female, Ryan? That's all I can remember off the top of my head.
Jennifer, you want to go next?
I figured you could go next, and then...
All right. I'm in the Ryan is not guilty camp. Also, I will say that even if he was guilty, I don't think that there's enough evidence to convict him. I think that there's plenty of reasonable doubt that he should not have been convicted, whether or not he actually did commit the crime. But let's start with the whole, I don't think he actually murdered her. First and foremost, that comes down to the fact that everyone is really harping on whether or not his verbiage whenever he was talking on the phone means that he was guilty or not. Like, he just found his wife underwater in a bathtub for he doesn't know how long. He's clearly panicking. Like, misspeaking is kind of coming with the territory there. Like, I misspeak all the time when I'm freaking out, and, you know, that's not nearly as much pressure as finding your wife drowning in a bathtub. So I don't really buy that. I also would agree that in my case, I would pull someone out of a bathtub first, but if his first instinct was to get rid of the threat and pull the water up, I don't necessarily think that that's a bad instinct either. Like, he's pulling her up out of the water and then getting the water out of the way, and again, panicking and then running to get help. The other thing is that when he pulled her out and laid her down on the carpet, they said that her body was dry, right? But one of the paramedics actually wrote in their notes that her hair was wet, not that it was damp, though he testified later in court that it was damp. So initially he wrote wet, which would suggest that she was in fact completely under the water. Her head was, at least. But then they also pulled up that carpet where they found the blood, and there was enough water in there that it soaked through whatever bag there was. So while there may not have been as much water on her body, there was certainly water beneath her.
Why were they putting wet carpet in a lunch paper sack?
You know, these are great questions, and I have absolutely no answer for you. Okay. Like, that seems really stupid.
I thought evidence bags were those clear bags that have evidence in red, and it's like a Ziploc.
That is what Criminal Minds has taught me.
Is what Criminal Minds has taught me. We don't use lunch sacks. This is no Dollar Tree budget. Come on.
Criminal Minds is gospel around here. If you do not adhere to Criminal Minds rules, you do not deserve to be in law enforcement.
Hear, hear.
Get the fuck out. Then I also don't hold it against him that he didn't testify, because again, pressure with attorneys like coming at you like that. Like, I dated a guy who was pre-law once. Arguing with him was terrible. Like, holy mother of God. One word, and all of a sudden it just turned into a whole other argument. Like, no, no.
That sounds like what I do.
There is not enough evidence in this case, no matter if you believe that he killed his wife or not, to convict him in a court of law. They have no fucking idea why or how he did it. And I know they don't have to prove motive whenever they're going after someone, but you're coming at this presuming innocence, not presuming guilt.
You're supposed to, anyway.
You're supposed to. You're supposed to 100% prove that he did it. And instead, it sounds like most jurors and most people put the burden on the defense to prove that he didn't, mm-hmm. which is not how the entire justice system is supposed to work. So I think we can argue whether or not he was guilty all we want. It's sort of a moot point. He shouldn't have been convicted no matter what. Though I still don't buy that he did. He didn't have any motive for it.
See, I think that his motive was that he was so quick to jump on the Sarah 2 and Jennifer bandwagon. I'm a little skeptical that there was an affair.
What was the timeline for those relationships after she was dead?
A year.
Like, so it took a year after she died for him to start a relationship with Sarah 2?
They were probably communicating before that, but said relationship.
Like, pregnancy was like a year. But he talked to Jennifer before he talked to Sarah, too. And Jennifer claims that he said that he wanted to marry her and take care of her children.
Well, he also jumped in pretty quickly with Sarah 1, though. Like, they were married after 2 years.
That's true. They did. He did propose really quickly with Sarah 1. Yeah.
They moved in together after 6 months. They bought a house together after six months. Yeah, they bought a house together after 6 months.
Yeah, because they started dating at 23, and she was 24 whenever she passed away, and they were already married for 4 months. So that was a...
That was fast.
That was a wham, bam, thank you, ma'am.
No shit. Point being, the dude moves quickly.
Well, Jennifer enters the chat. I am still so on the fence over whether or not he did it. Like, I'm still so on the fence about if he did it or not. I mean, so the whole weird bathtub scenario, I can also understand why you're reacting. Okay, this is a high pressure situation. If he's innocent and didn't murder her, it's a high pressure situation. People don't always act logically in high pressure situations. I know I often do not act logically in high pressure situations compared to how I would act when I actually have time to think about what I'm doing. So you have a guy who, if he's innocent, walks into the bathroom, sees his wife motionless, face under the water in the tub, I would instantly be freaking out. And I wouldn't necessarily act in ways that other people would expect me to later, once they're like literally dissecting every little thing I said or did. So I can see, like, he sees her underwater, he's like, gotta get her head above water, and then, you know, perhaps he doesn't want to like move her yet for whatever reason. Like, he doesn't actually know why she's underwater. She could have fallen asleep, or I think more likely, I'll get to that in a second. But so he's like moving her out of the water. If he wants to run and get his phone, you're not necessarily going to, you don't want to like have the water still in the tub because she could fall back under. So I could see draining it, but I could also see just pulling her out of the tub. So that seems weird to me, but again, maybe not making the best decisions at this time because he's freaking out. So then he makes the 911 call. We already know that he seems to be kind of weird with his verbal communication. At least that's attested to by multiple other people within his family and his coworkers, that he's not the best with verbal communication. So how he comes across in the phone call, I also feel like that's really slippery evidence to kind of hold for or against him. You know, people were like picking apart his, like, I think she fell asleep in the bathtub. Well, no, technically no one can fall asleep in the bathtub. And I'm like, if I just see someone like laying in the bath, like, I don't know, whatever comes out of my mouth, like it may not be like medically accurate as to what happened. Yeah. So that was kind of funny that people were like getting really into like the specific details of the call. However, the fact that she was like kind of dry. Like, I don't know, maybe if she's laying on carpet, that would dry her off faster than if she was laying on tile floor. Like, I would expect more puddles on tile. And I think, I really do think the prosecution, I mean, obviously the prosecution wasn't going to be arguing in favor of anything that would acquit Ryan.
Right.
But the way in which so many people just dismissed the fact that Sarah could fall asleep in literally any situation really bothered me. Like, specifically, there was one instance where the lady who held season tickets ahead of Ryan, like at the Bengals games or whatever, and she meets Sarah and then looks back in a stadium, which are very loud, I will add, yeah. And Sarah's just sleeping. That totally sounds like narcolepsy to me. And that would certainly lend some weight behind the statement that she could have had like an episode. Like, that doesn't sound like normal sleeping to me. That sounds like there's like some sort of neurological issue.
I'm so surprised that he did not take her to a doctor beforehand. She's just falling asleep in places like that. Why did no one take her to a doctor beforehand?
Okay, so she was an adult at this time, so like she could kind of brush off other people's concerns, but apparently this was a thing since like childhood, and her parents like didn't take her to get checked out. I found that really strange.
So she was, they thought whenever she, in my outside research, they thought she had a heart murmur whenever she was little, but she was born with a cleft palate. So she got surgery on it whenever she was 11. She had to have an EKG for her surgery. They found no heart murmur. So that takes, her doctor said that kind of takes out the thought of having the disease that they
like
thought.
Like a heart condition.
Yeah, yeah. So they didn't think that it was anything to do with her heart. And you would likely find a heart murmur in the, I don't know how to say it, the disease in the book that they're trying to say that she has.
Oh, yeah.
Long QT syndrome?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So yeah, usually you would find that on an EKG, and they did not find it whenever she got her cleft palate surgery whenever she was 11.
I don't know. I think they botched the autopsy. I think the coroner botched the autopsy. I think that was way too rushed. And I think that the witness that the defense called pointing out you didn't take these brain samples, like that would have been like such an easier way to prove or disprove Ryan's statement on potentially having an undiagnosed health condition. And we didn't get that evidence. And then, of course, Ryan cremated the body, and now there's no way of getting that evidence.
I feel like you shouldn't be allowed to cremate a body if there's a homicide investigation or trial going on. You should not be allowed. That body should be kept away somewhere.
Not smart. Yeah. I mean, the police do still have those blood samples that they got off of the carpet. So there are some DNA samples out there if they do want to do some sort of genetic testing to see if she does maybe have markers for long QT syndrome, which I don't really, well, I see the harm in the prosecution's case, but that seems like something that should be investigated at the very least, to send that out for some simple testing to see if that marker is there.
That should have been done before the trials.
You're not wrong.
Yeah. I think, so this is, to wrap up my long-winded statement on this question, I'm really on the fence over whether or not he did this, but I 100% agree with Paige that the prosecution did not prove to me that he did it. I think that there's various small pieces of evidence, suggestions, implications that he did. But the prosecution didn't do their job, in my opinion, because you're supposed to prove with 100% certainty that this person has committed the crime that prosecution is saying. And I'm like, I just don't feel like that happened.
Oh, no, I don't think that in a court of law that he's guilty, but I think he did it.
He did it.
I don't think that they showed enough for him to be in jail for it.
Yeah.
I don't think any lawyer involved in this case really proved anything. Like, no. Nobody, there was not a good lawyer involved here.
They should have brought in outside lawyers. Like, if you're from a small town where there's not murders, not murder trials going on, don't use a lawyer from that town.
Yeah. Yeah.
Bring someone in from a bigger city that's experienced with doing it.
Yeah, yeah. If you're dealing with the first homicide case in your county in, what, over a decade or more, you need somebody who knows what the fuck they're doing. You're not that far from Cincinnati. Call some people, for Christ's sake. Like, come on.
Or call a coroner. Get a second opinion from... Bring in people that know what they're doing. Hello, do we not watch Criminal Minds? Bring in the BAU. Let's go.
Criminal Minds is gospel here.
I want to see Reed on that witness stand, okay?
Right? If Spencer Reed isn't there, I don't believe your shit.
Take his photographic memory to that scene.
Well, I guess the next question in our discussion questions.
Okay, this is also yours.
Thank you very much.
Yeah. Do you think it is wrong of the media to get this involved in true crime cases?
Yeah, kind of do.
What do you think?
Okay, listen, I might be a web sleuth and this is totally going to diss myself, but yeah. Okay, so cold cases, I get, because you're looking, it's fresh eyes on a case. You know, maybe they know something that someone else doesn't. But if Ryan gets out, so he's up for parole in 2025. So if he gets granted his parole and he comes out, his face has been smeared all across the internet. What chance of a normal life does he get? Even if they found him not guilty, they dragged his name through the mud. What chance of a normal life is he going to get?
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, zero.
That's
just zero. No chance.
That's an excellent point. Yeah. So I was thinking about this question and I'm of two minds on this one, because for one thing, I'm thinking that if the media is this involved, there are some cases that may have gone under the radar that need the exposure of the public at large to keep interest going and to force public defenders, prosecutors, things like that to continue to defend cases. It also pushes things like social justice agendas into the forefront. So I think that that's important. But I don't know if you guys have seen that show on Netflix, Trial by Media, yet.
Mm-mm.
Okay, watch it. Both of you will love it. But there's one case in there where there is one dude in Birmingham, Alabama, who I think was like a CEO for a healthcare company down there that got huge. Billions of dollars involved, right? And the guy is getting being sued for embezzlement, right? And they find two of these local good old boy attorneys in Birmingham, Alabama.
Oh, I already don't like this.
Who spun the case so hard that they got this dude off for embezzling a shit ton of money because they spoke to an Alabama jury like an Alabama jury wanted to be spoken to, as opposed to federal prosecutors who came in and spoke about, you know, tax forms and money or whatever, and just like super dry shit. Whereas these guys just seem like somebody you wanted to hang out and have a beer with. So that dude got off because they turned the whole trial into a show. Like, they pulled the media into their thing. They tainted the jury pool. Probably what happened to Ryan whenever they submitted that horrible looking photo of him looking like a murderer.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it can be used for good, but it also can be used in a terrible, terrible way.
Yeah, like, don't fuck with cats. All those people,
oh my gosh, yeah,
that found that murderer, like, that wouldn't have been solved without people, that Facebook group, getting so hyper-involved in it. Which, like, that's amazing.
True.
But
yes,
it's a double-edged sword.
It is very much a double-edged sword.
I've never used that correctly. I'm so proud of myself. You can leave that in.
Yeah.
Okay, I will.
We're honored that this happened on our podcast episode.
You gonna call mom after this?
Yeah, I really am. Hey, mom.
Really, this book highlights a larger issue that has been getting to me after having really like this true crime binge that we've been going through on Netflix, and kind of just following other true crime cases over the past few years, because I am at least probably not at Kayla's level of interest in true crime, but I am interested in true crime for sure. And representation matters. It matters a lot. And I think we like to think of ourselves individually as being very objective and unbiased, but that simply is not the case. And the justice system is one of those places where that plays out to some really horrible endings for some people. Juries can be easily manipulated by either the prosecutors or the defense. I just hate how much of our justice process revolves around this showmanship aspect within the law. You know, like when, for example, in Ryan's case, where they bring in the bathtub and everyone's just captivated by the bathtub because they're just thinking about Sarah's last moments that occurred in this bathtub, even though the expert that the defense brought in for the bathtub specifically said he couldn't make any conclusive statements as to what happened or how these prints occurred. Like, he wasn't giving any conclusive evidence on this. But just the mere fact that they wheeled it into the courthouse, you know, it was such a dramatic act and undoubtedly influenced the jury. And we talked about this before, his kind of his jail mugshot, obviously not his actual mugshot, but the scary Ryan picture, as if that's what Janice calls it, the scary Ryan picture. You plaster that on the front page of a newspaper versus his like professional work photo, and you're just going to get a different reaction because people will be influenced by that picture. And we see this also when it comes to portrayals of people of color in the media. That's like another huge issue, is that people are just very biased towards people of color, and the photos that newspapers choose to run and the words that they choose to use to describe people can have a huge impact on whether or not you think someone is innocent or guilty. And I think Ryan was definitely a victim of that as well, with the photos of him that were circulated. So yeah, I think they shouldn't get as involved as they did with this case. And obviously, because yeah, at the end of the day, for them, yes, maybe an individual reporter wants to uncover the truth, but a lot of it is newspapers need to sell to make money. And so they're going to print really scandalous things because, like, negative things are more likely to catch people's interest. And yeah, so I think they can have a definite negative impact on some cases.
Well, and so many headlines were like, college-educated man drowns wife. Why is it such a shock that someone that's college-educated could murder someone? Like, he doesn't fit your typical criminal profile of what you expect, so now you have to add that as a shock value? Like, come on.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, I noticed that too when I was reading it.
Yeah, she said college-educated. College-educated man, no record. Yeah. College education man, no record.
I'm like, that shouldn't, well, I think probably statistically across the U.S., you are less likely to commit a crime if you're college educated. But just because you're college educated doesn't mean you didn't murder somebody.
So yeah.
It's just like, that is not helpful in this instance.
Not a disqualifying factor. All right. So this last question is mine. So let me preface this a bit. So I came to my conclusion after reading this book, which had tons and tons of background information, and we had all of the information from all three trials here. But if you were a juror in just one of these trials, and I'll let you pick which one, would it have changed your opinion at all if you only had the information presented within that one trial without any of the other context?
Yes. And I think that it would also, I mean, yes and no, because you have that man that goes on to, like, I think he did like a radio show, and he said, oh, we came to the conclusion because I think he drowned her in the bathtub or the toilet. And like, the toilet was never mentioned in the trial that he attended, that he was a juror for, but he still came to that conclusion. So he must have known something from a different trial. So it's like that put, so now those jurors from that case are sitting there thinking, okay, was it bathtub? Was it toilet? Was it sink? The next people are just sitting there focusing on the bathtub. And so I think that whenever you're given more options of how he could have done it, that's going to make you think that he's more guilty than, okay, there's just this one thing to focus on. Could he have done it in this scenario?
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. I'll say that I was thinking about this because I was thinking about Ryan's mom whenever I was talking about this, and her drastically different versions of her testimony in each of those. Like, if I had been in trial three and I hadn't seen how much the prosecution's case had changed, her mom's testimony would have held a lot of weight with me. But the fact that it changes so much makes me pretty much disregard anything that she says, because she's just getting progressively angrier. She has to direct her anger at someone, and it sounds like the longer this trial is going on, the more she's fixating on Ryan is the reason that her daughter is gone.
Sarah's mom. You said Ryan's mom at the beginning.
Sarah's mom. Sarah's mom progressively gets angrier. Ryan's mom didn't testify, I don't think.
No. That is true, because at the beginning, you know, she's sitting on his side. She doesn't think, first trial, she's totally has his back. Second trial, she gets up there and she says, they talk to each other a way that I would never talk to my husband. That's just a sign of the times. It's what she says in her second trial. Third trial, she's standing with Orion's guilty support group, holding their hand while the verdict is being read. So she escalates real quick.
It's like, what happened there?
Yeah, what went on behind closed doors?
Yeah, yeah. Well, I mean, because there were those mentions of the family meeting privately with prosecutors. So what exactly were the prosecutors saying that really changed their mind? Because honestly, the evidence that was presented in each trial wouldn't really change my mind either way. I would probably continue to think what I had already like formed my opinion on, despite the evidence that they offered, because I feel like a lot of the evidence that they offered was kind of circumstantial, and the defense also countered with similarly circumstantial like defenses against that evidence. So none of it was really convincing either way. So it's like, what happened in between these trials that made Sarah's mom change her mind?
I wonder if like having Jennifer show up kind of like poked her a little bit, and then, you know, she finds out about Sarah too. And then that just sets her over like, okay, my daughter's dead, and now you got another girl pregnant within a year.
Yeah.
It's like, how much do you miss your wife if you're already ready to move on?
Yeah. I don't know. Like, I think on an emotional level, Sarah's mom's testimony would hold weight, like Paige mentioned. But in terms of like the actual evidence that it provides, I don't know that it actually provides a lot. You know, in terms That's of fair. Like, oh, I haven't read trial transcripts, so I can't say that for certain. Her just saying in the third trial that their relationship was hateful, that's like a really strong statement. So that might have given me some pause as a juror in the third trial.
Yeah, she was doing a lot of like character defamation.
Yeah. Especially you didn't hear much about Ryan's character from any of his people because the judge kept cutting him off.
Right.
All right. Closing arguments?
Ryan is a murderer.
Okay, so Kayla did not change her opinion.
No. Listen, I've known about this case. I started researching about 6 months ago. There's no way my mind's being changed. I don't think he should be in jail. I don't think there's been enough arguments for that. But sketchy.
I appreciate your consistency.
One opinionated girl.
Yes, we've met. I'm aware.
Okay, just making
sure. Yeah, I'm still on the fence. I have no idea. I don't know.
Okay, not that he should be in jail or should not be in jail. That, like, not including, did they make a good enough argument? Based on the evidence that you know, what do you think?
Yeah, see, that's the issue. I 100% think that he shouldn't have been convicted with the evidence that they presented.
Right.
Because I agree. I don't think it was enough to prove that he did it.
No,
but, like, I am inclined to think that he did, except for her really fucking weird sleepiness.
Okay, but if you fall asleep, water hits your face, you're waking up. You go underwater and you go to breathe and all you get is water, your gag reflex is going to kick in. You're going to start hacking up a lung. At that point, he would hear you because the downstairs TV was not turned to the correct channel, Mr. Ryan. No. But the bedroom one was. So that also could be, you know what, maybe he didn't kill her, but he changed the story because he thought maybe he would get in trouble for being in the bedroom and not noticing that she had slipped under the water. Or maybe he heard her choke and cough on the water and didn't go check on her.
Because he thought maybe she just choked
on some water. And then that's what suffocated her. So maybe he thought, okay, well, like, it's some kind of, like, negligence charge and changed his story up there. But he just lied and switched his story too many times for him to have not done something wrong. Was she face up? Was she face down? Were you in the living room? Were you in the bedroom? Yeah. What was it, buddy?
I could buy the negligence version of events, but that still wouldn't be enough for me to convict him.
Can you be convicted for that? If he was in the bedroom and she choked on some water and he didn't run in?
I mean, of a negligence charge, you might be, but...
Yeah, possibly.
You'd still have to prove that, again, beyond reasonable doubt, and the evidence still isn't there for that.
Well, wouldn't at that point, if you were facing, like, life, wouldn't you be like, okay, Hi, sorry, I'm ready to confess of what I actually did to get, like, the lesser charge. Or is that
I don't think
not?
You get life or negligence.
Well, yeah, but he was getting life for murder. So if you know you're facing life, why wouldn't you be like, hey, I actually switched my story because I thought I'd get in trouble for not rushing in. Here's what really went down. Negligence.
That could really backfire on you, though, because that would only work if the prosecutor's office agreed to a deal like that.
Mm.
And if the prosecutor's office doesn't agree to that deal, they're going to take you switching your story and trying to get a plea deal as further evidence of your guilt for murdering her. So I feel like even if that is what happened, it would be kind of a risky move to like ask to change your plea for a reduction
especially,
in sentence.
Yeah, especially once you get to trial three, because then he was already offered a plea deal for 5 years, which is nothing.
I probably would have taken that, to be honest.
You'd just be Anne Perry. Move to Scotland, start your book series. Go ahead.
Right? Yeah, I think I'd take the 5 years and then go international.
I feel like that's what Ryan's going to have to do. He's going to have to pack it up and go somewhere.
He's going to have to change his name and move somewhere else. Yeah. Like,
yeah,
out of the U.S.
That's exactly what he's going to have to do.
If he would write a book first, that'd be fantastic. Because, so, he's already gone to jail, so he might as well, when he comes out, be like, yeah, I did it.
That's true. He can't be charged again. For
that's what O.J.
Time.
Simpson did. He wrote that If I Did It book. So, someone get that man a book deal.
Ugh, gross.
Ryan, not O.J. Simpson.
Just and then we can talk about it on the podcast.
My gross still stands. Profiting off of someone murder, you get it on gross.
See everyone in a year for that book review.
We'll invite you back on if we get a Ryan Whitmer book and you can review it for us.
Oh my gosh, I'd be so passionate about that. He could literally sit there and be like, I didn't do it. I'd be like, liar!
He was screaming at the screaming at the book.
Yeah.
I know you did it.
You did it. I go to a book signing just to be like, I know you did it.
Jesus. You know what this kind of reminds me of is one of the Netflix documentaries we started watching is called The Staircase.
Oh, yeah.
It's about like this author who murdered his wife, question mark, saying that she fell down a staircase and literally, okay, so the whole thing was 10 episodes, which were like an hour long. It was way too long. So we only ended up watching like the first three episodes. And by the end of episode three, I was like, I literally don't know. I don't know. I don't know what to believe. Yeah. I don't know if he pushed her down the stairs or hit her in the head or if she just like fell down the stairs. I don't know. And that's kind of how I feel about this case. I'm like, I could see him murdering her, and I could also see it being some sort of horrible accident. I don't know. So I'm not taking a stand for this one.
So we've got three different opinions from three different people.
I'm on your ass, single case. Ryan.
Well, I'm not going to be joining any free Ryan Whitmer clubs anytime soon, so.
No, neither am I.
Who knows? He might end up marrying him. Like Sarah, too.
Yikes. Ugh. I wonder if he's going to marry her when he gets out of prison.
I think they broke up already.
Did they?
Yeah.
I wonder what his kid thinks.
Well, his kid's got to be like 6 now, right? No. That third case was in 2010, so he's got to be like, what, 11?
Yeah.
Huh.
That's crazy. That's wild.
That's insane.
He's old enough to have an opinion.
He is, if he's 11.
Maybe he should write a book.
Like, what does his mother tell him about his father?
Yeah, you where know? Do you think your dad
what
is?
What do you tell your kid?
And especially if they don't have a relationship anymore. Like, then it's really weird to kind of, like, mediate that.
Do you think she's nice about it? Or do you think she's like, your dad murdered someone?
Your dad's a murderer.
Well, she was a groupie who...
Yeah, but now they're broken up. So maybe she'd be petty with her comments. You never know.
Yeah, and that also, like, would the kid get to visit Ryan? Like, would he get, you know, like, visitation rights to see him? And now that they're not in a relationship, would Sarah, too, just be like, I'm not taking you, you know? Like, I don't know. That sounds messy. Basically, if you're being accused of murder, maybe your best move is not to start dating and having children with other people.
Yeah. Especially another woman named Sarah. I mean, come on.
Yeah, dude.
Yikes.
You gotta type.
Yeah.
Yeah. Hard stop, buddy. Like, I'm on your side, but that does not look
Man,
good.
Man, that chapter, whenever it ends, and they were like, but here's secret two. The baby is Ryan's. I was like, the scandal. I even knew it. I already knew it, but just to hear it, and then the chapter ends, I was like, Janice, don't do me like that.
Seriously, this book cracked me up, like, how it was written. It was, like, so dramatic at points.
It was so dramatic.
It was great.
You could tell it was done by a newscaster. But
later on, I found another document that no one else had seen in 15 years, and I'm like, Janice, calm the fuck down.
But see, it's just funnier if you think of it in a newscaster voice.
Yeah.
Because she's a reporter. I'm just like, and then we discovered it was his baby. I love it.
Well, and that wraps up our discussion of Submerged by Janice Heil. A huge shout out and thank you to our special guest for this bonus episode, Kayla. Thank you for coming on. Thank you for picking a very interesting book for us to cover this week or this month.
I thought you guys would hate it. I was so nervous.
No, this was very interesting. Yeah. This was super interesting, so I'm very glad you picked it, because I also love true crime, and I got to talk about it a lot for this episode. So, all right, and if you enjoyed this month's episode, please do consider leaving us a review. If you are able to do so, that definitely helps us out, plus we love to give feedback. If you're interested in keeping up with the podcast, you can follow us on social media. We have a Twitter and an Instagram, both of them at big_book_energy. And you can also check out our website, bigbookenergy.com, where we occasionally post little bookish blog posts like listicles and book reviews and that sort of thing. And if you would like to support the podcast and also get awesome books at the same time, you can visit our bookshop store, which is at bookshop.org/shop/bigbookenergy. And most of the books that we talk about in our episodes are available to be purchased there. It helps support us. You support local booksellers and you get an awesome book in exchange. Unfortunately, bookshop.org does not have Submerged available. So currently at the time of recording, you cannot purchase Submerged in our bookshop store, but I'm going to keep checking back to see if they get it in stock.
But Janice has her own website where you can get the book there from Janice herself.
Yes, Janice does have her own website where you can purchase it. You can also purchase it on Amazon, although we don't have an affiliate program with them, and those will be linked in our show notes if you'd like a copy of Submerged.
And we also have a Patreon account if you would like to support us that way. If you enjoyed this episode and you want to follow in Kayla's footsteps and be on your on an episode all your own, all you have to do is sign up to be on our Book Elder tier for 1 month, and then you get to pick a book that we review and be on the show with us and fight with us about whether or not someone is guilty of murder, if you would like to do that.
All right, and that is it for today. Thanks for listening, and we will see you next time. Bye!
Bye.
Bye, cool cats and kittens.
During this time, During this time, Sarah's family cut off contact with Ryan. How's it going, buddy?
Who, me?
Yeah, you.
I'm just chilling. I'm just ready to fight. I've had 3 cups of coffee, man. I'm ready to go.
Oh, shit. Okay. I think I need more coffee then.